Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Jonathan Clark, who is a former British diplomat, now a foreign policy scholar at the Cato Institute. He is co-author with Stefan Halper of America Alone, the Neoconservatives, and the Global Order. Jonathan, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Hong Kong, so I'm a child of the British Empire. Mm. Hong Kong then was a very, very different place from what it is today. Hong Kong, when I was born, was a place of about 2 million people compared with 6 or 7 million people today. It was a very traditional Chinese society, none of the hustle and bustle and the high rises that there are today, and was ruled really completely by the British, part of the British Empire taken under the days of Queen Victoria, a very different place, and that's where I grew up for the first 10 to 15 years of my life.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, I think one thing they did was to take me to strange and remote places, and that's the, in a sense, the path that I followed, interest in international affairs, interest in Asian affairs. My major at Oxford was Chinese, so I think that's something that they gave to me, that really that interest in the world as a global place, the place that you ought to visit right around the place.
And was your father a diplomat?
No, my father was not. In a sense, because it was a crown colony and was part of the British Empire, the British were not diplomats there, they were actually running the government. So he was part of the civil servants, the Hong Kong government, which was running Hong Kong. He was he was a town planner, he was shaping the emergence of the new city of Hong Kong at an extraordinarily interesting time, because during that time the communist government in mainland China was I guess you'd say a pretty repressive place. And there was a constant stream of refugees from mainland China into Hong Kong, as I said before, increasing the population by leaps and bounds, doubling it within 10 years. And he was responsible really for accommodating all those people, for planning the town, building the apartment houses and so on. So that was an extremely interesting and challenging task, simply to accommodate a huge number of people coming into a place of 400 square miles. So this is not a big territory.
Mm-hmm. So you breathe internationalism from the early days.
I think
really.
I did.
You said you went to Oxford.
I was at Oxford, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And say again what you did your work on.
Well, I did two things. I did the sort of first classical path of many British schoolboys at the time. I studied, or read, as we used to call it at Oxford, Latin and Greek, and that was my first major. I did that for 2.5 years, and then I switched to Chinese. Mm. Now, Chinese in those days at Oxford was almost a sort of spin-off of classics. The way it was approached was very much as a sort of analytic, literary-based field of study, and the study of modern Chinese, of written Chinese, spoken Chinese, was, I'm afraid to say, virtually non-existent. So, of course, it's completely changed today. So I have a sort of a grounding in classical Chinese, and classical Chinese poetry, philosophy, and so on.
Do you read and speak Chinese Mandarin today's language?
Well, it's a tough language, I hope none of your listeners are going to call in and ask me a question in Chinese.
Okay.
But I mean, after my completing my degree at Oxford, I did in fact go out to Taiwan for a year, where I learnt spoken standard Chinese. I haven't used it as much as I would like in recent years, and it's unlike French or German or Italian, it's a language which slips into the background more easily. So I would say that I still have an understanding of it, but not a fluent one.
So it sounds that the choice of the diplomatic service, the foreign service of Great Britain, was kind of natural for you, having been in all these places and actually been raised in Hong Kong.
Yes, it really was. It was something I was interested in from an early stage, and something which I thought I would try out for throughout my career at Oxford, having seen the international stage from early life. I did want to play a part in it as a career.
What do you think are the skills and the temperament required to be a diplomat?
Well, you know, there's an old joke about diplomacy, that, you know, the art of diplomacy is telling somebody to go to hell and making him look forward to the journey. So so I suppose that one of the things is, I mean, there are two aspects there. The first aspect is that you're there to defend the interests of your country. You're there to represent, you know, the person who's sending you abroad to advance, in my case, British interests, to make sure that they flourish as best as possible. And the second part of it, and that in a sense is the hard part, you know, that's the cutting edge of it. And the second part, which you might call the soft aspect, is the ability to persuade, is the ability to take your interests and make them the interests of the party to whom you're talking, to make them to see, yes, well, the British want to go in that direction. Well, that sounds like a good idea, to persuade them, in other words, mm-hmm. Whether it is or not against their interests. So on the one hand, you're standing up for your own country, standing up for what their needs are. And secondly, you're trying to listen, you're trying to work with the people that you're to whom you're accredited.
A sense of the history and culture of both where you're coming from and where you're going as a diplomat must be terribly important.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's not a lot of point really in the sense disdaining the culture of the place that you're sent to. I mean, if you don't know anything about Nigerian culture, you're going to be unhappy in Nigeria. If you don't know the local language, if you are out of sympathy with what they're where they're coming from, in other words, you're probably not going to be a particularly successful diplomat. Now, the one thing you have to be a little bit careful of is being so-called captured by the local by the local culture, and this does happen sometimes. Is you almost end up as you're seen by the capital. You're seen as being sort of being turned by the host government, and you're suddenly becoming an advocate of the host government's interests back to London or back to Washington, and that's something which is sort of, you know, clientitis, it's called, and something you have to be a little bit careful of. But an absolute understanding and familiarity with the local culture is something which is a complete requirement.
This dilemma of your home port, so to speak, your home base, the country that you're representing, having ideas about what should be done which are inconsistent with the realities on the ground must recur again and again, I assume.
Absolutely. I mean, the experience in my career was in Zimbabwe. I was part of the British team that was at the Lancaster House Conference, which brought then Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, to independence.
This is the negotiations led by Lord Carrington.
Exactly, yes.
Who was a guest on our program 20 years ago.
A very fine man indeed. And I think that was a tremendous triumph of diplomacy. And very much illustrates the point that I was making before, is that Lord Carrington had a very clear idea of the destination that we wanted to arrive at. And he had tremendous patience and negotiating skills to persuade what was really a very difficult audience, in Mr. Mugabe and Mr. Nkomo, Ian Smith, Muzorewa, to accept our ideas. And by the way, there was also a little crossfire from President Carter at the time, who didn't fully line up behind some of the British ideas. But to come back to Zimbabwe, we faced precisely that dilemma when I was in the British Embassy. We call it a High Commission in Zimbabwe, and to try and transmit to the new government of Zimbabwe our ideas about where they should go was a very finely balanced thing indeed, because the new government, naturally enough, wanted to show its independence from Britain. In a sense, it felt it had been fighting against Britain throughout the Civil War, and Mr. Mugabe himself is a difficult character to deal with. He was difficult even then in 1980, and to portray the advice that you were giving as disinterested, genuine advice rather than neo-colonial lecturing was something which I'm afraid we didn't always get right, and perhaps there were faults on both sides. But anyway, the communications broke down fairly rapidly on exactly that point.
You mean after Zimbabwe had its independence?
Precisely, yes. Yeah. But we still had, you know, the British government at that stage had a variety of interests, but what we really wanted was to make sure that the transition was a smooth and stable one, and that the new government of Zimbabwe was able to take advantage of what we saw were the tremendous resources available to it, both natural resources and human resources, all of which required a moderate type of social market democracy. And Mr. Mugabe himself came from a rather different background, where his education, he was a very highly educated person, had three advanced degrees, but his education was much more in line with Marxist economic systems, and therefore we were trying to, if at all possible, to steer him away from that that approach, which had been tried, as we saw it, disastrously elsewhere in Africa, in Tanzania, in Ghana, and we were trying to say, well, you know, now it's 1980, those systems have been tried, let's try something different. But of course he was saying, well, you know, we're in charge now, and so that was the sort of the dilemma that we faced, and it was wasn't an easy trick to pull off.
And the outcome today is not a positive one, but what you're suggesting is that it's kind of difficult to see places like Zimbabwe as fitting some grand formula. I guess Zimbabwe has been listed in as one of the outposts of tyranny in a way, and things are very bad there. But it sounds like one really has to take into account the peculiarities of its history and of its leadership, basically, to understand the disaster that it has become.
That's right. I mean, I'm afraid Zimbabwe is I don't think anybody would find it easy to say a good word about what has happened today. And it really is a terrible tragedy, because Zimbabwe was a country highly endowed with human resources. When the Gold Coast became independent in 1960, the first of the British colonies in Africa to become independent, to gain independence, there was, believe it or not, one African graduate, just one. Mm. In Zimbabwe, there were many thousands, people educated in the United States, educated in Britain, France, Germany, many of whom flooded back to Zimbabwe, hoping to contribute to what they saw as successful evolution. And I'm afraid that they were, their inputs were shunned. And I think it does indicate the point that you were making, is that that leadership, the personality of a leader, is very, very, very important indeed. And the British were, I'm afraid, not successful in keeping Mr. Mugabe on the path of moderation.
Let's talk about your new book. It's been out for a year now, but America Alone: The Neoconservatives and the Global Order. I'm curious, in what way did this background prep you in a way to write this book, which in a way is a statement about where America is? It isn't a report back to the Foreign Office, but written more for a general audience. But there's similarities here, right?
Well, where I think that I'm coming from on this is that throughout my diplomatic career in the British Foreign Service, I worked very, very closely with the United States on a great number of different issues in Western Europe, in East Asia, in Central America, areas which were both controversial and contentious and difficult to manage. But what I really admired about American policy at that time, and something I sort of looked to, was I thought that America, during the Cold War, really occupied the moral high ground. It had what you might call moral authority. An easy way of putting this would be to say that, you know, the doors were open to the United States. You didn't have to kick them down. And so I admired the American, what you might call the, as a default agent for good around the world. And coming now, I now live in Washington, D.C., and looking over the unfolding Afghan situation and Iraq situation post 9/11, it seemed to me that America, in a sense, was turning its back on some of those traditions which had stood it in such good stead during the Cold War, that some of those traditions were being jettisoned, particularly that unilateralism was being favored, that the military option was arriving too early in the day, and therefore the United States was somehow losing that moral high ground. That's not to say that the aspirations of American policy were in question, not at all. What I'm saying is the means that they were being pursued by somehow gave me pause. And that's what led me to think that, you know, having seen what I saw as successful American diplomacy for 30, 40, 50 years, suddenly to see on the back of this terrible tragedy, 9/11, those successful traditions being, as I saw it, overturned, that sort of led me to think that really a book that identified what was happening, clarified it to the American public, would perhaps serve as a sort of incentive to go back to some of those well-established mainstream traditions.
And you come out of a tradition, as you said earlier, focused on knowing, defining the interests of your own country. And what you and your co-authors seem to be saying here is that a set of ideas have really distorted America's sense of its own national interest in a global context, but also has distorted the interplay between values and interests that are part of any country's foreign policy.
I think that's exactly the way the imbalance has arisen, which is that a set of ideas. Now, how would you define neoconservative ideas? They're not difficult to pin down. They're not easy to pin down. It is rather a moving target. But if you can probably group them around four themes, one of which is the sense of a binary world, the world divided into good and evil, not too many shades of gray. One, the use of military force, the use of American military technological supremacy to achieve diplomatic ends. Thirdly, a sense of unilateralism, that the United States can work with allies, but really it just as well work alone. And fourthly, a really a concentration on the Middle East to the detriment, perhaps, of the United States' global interest. And I think it's those ideas that came to prominence. I mean, each one of those ideas you can argue about, but if you put them all together, those ideas came to the surface and started to, I think, take American policy on a bit of a detour post 9/11, and that's in the sense that what myself, my co-author Steph Halper, were trying to do was to get off that detour and back onto the sort of wide open path of American diplomacy.
Now, I think another central argument is that the neoconservatives, and we will talk in a minute about who they are, basically the bottom line here is that they are an interest group that emerged in the latter phases of the Cold War, which morphed, did not remain the same, and we'll talk about that in a second, but that in a way, American foreign policy, because of the opportunity presented by 9/11, the election of a Republican president who had no sort of background in foreign policy, that these circumstances came together to make the paramount to give this group an important impact, if not the defining impact, on the direction that the country would take after 9/11.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think it's true to say that had 9/11 not happened, then neoconservatism would have gone down as a relatively minor aspect of American foreign policy thinking. At the end of the Cold War, somebody observed that neoconservatism had been a sort of round trip from Trotskyism to anachronism, and they looked as though they were going out of business. But they did reconstitute themselves in the 1990s with a tremendous focus on what was going on in the Middle East, which they saw as crucial to American interests, that America could get drawn into all sorts of extraordinarily unattractive engagements in the Middle East, either over oil or over defense of Israel, and that Therefore, the United States needed to take drastic interventionary measures in the Middle East. Now, if you remember back to President Bush's, well, then Governor Bush's statements as a candidate, he talked very much of himself as wanting to have a humble foreign policy, a foreign policy that listened to international countries, and didn't see the military as a sort of spearhead as nation builders. So, in fact, the neoconservatives at that time were in fact more in favor of John McCain as a candidate, and were in a sense disappointed at the outcome that when Governor Bush was elected, but. It's clear that you look at the evidence today that they were able to get Iraq discussed very early on in the Bush administration, able to achieve a prominence for it that would not otherwise have been there had one been looking simply at the global board of American foreign policy interests. And I think come 9/11, they had the plan. The president at that time had a tremendous political challenge, and they, in a sense, had the solution. They had to do a little bit of fancy footwork. They had to make sure that the target was defined not so only as Al Qaeda, but also as states that harbored terrorists. But once they'd done that, then the template that they had been developing during the 1990s came into being.
Let's go back a little in the history of the neoconservatives, because they really emerge the late 70s, maybe the early 80s, as a response to dissatisfaction with the liberal agenda at home in the United States, and a dissatisfaction with the Kissingerian policies of detente, really. Talk a little about that, because they were a very different group in that early phase than they became in the later phase.
That's right, because the interesting thing is that the name neoconservatives gives you an impression that this is a movement of the right. In fact, these people all emerge from not exactly a Trotskyist past, but certainly from a socialist background. Many of them sat around at the City University of New York in so-called Alcove 1, which was the alcove right next to Alcove 2, which was the Trotskyist. So they were the non-communist socialism. That's where they were coming from. Now, you're absolutely right that in the 60s and early 1970s, two things were going on in this country. One was the rise of one was the rise of the counterculture, the sort of rise of relativism, the rise of questioning of many of the sort of classic underpinnings of American political assumptions. That was going on the one hand. On the other hand, the internationally you had the Vietnam War that was unraveling, and there was the Kissingerian embrace of detente. Now this group of then leftist thinkers started to become discontented with both those aspects. On welfare, example, they started to think that the sort of entitlement culture that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, people like that, started to question that and to move from left to a more centrist and then rightist position. So that was on the domestic side. And on the international side, you had the group around Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington, who was a very, very strong anti-communist. And anti-communism, although this was a movement of the left, but anti-communism was always a very substantial intellectual underpinning of these people's thinking. And so as Senator Jackson got a group around him which said, look, we don't want to have detente with the Soviet Union. We don't want to have peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union. And by the way, when we're talking about Vietnam, stop talking as though it was America as a criminal country. The reason for this was happening. In fact, America may have gone off the rails, but it's not something which we should question the existence or the validity of the American ideal. So that moved them, or started the movement from left to right.
Mm-hmm. And this group of intellectuals, and the names here, people like Norman Podhoretz or Irving Kristol, you mentioned
Nathan Glaser, Daniel Bell, Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
Right. Yep. These were primarily men of ideas, although Moynihan did go into politics. But there was a parallel movement of complementary ideas within the national security bureaucracy itself, right, among intellectuals who primarily focused on issues of hardware and nuclear strategy.
That's right. Yeah, I think that the key person there is Albert Wohlstetter, who was a conceptualizer of the nuclear war. But he had one extremely important contribution in terms of neoconservative thought. Was he was the one who saw the emerging technology, the technological dominance of the United States, and what it actually could do for warfare. Now, he was a person who thought purely about nuclear war. Now, if you remember back then, the concept was mutually assured destruction, i.e. that both the Soviet Union and the United States, if they got into a nuclear exchange, it would just simply be all over, we'd all be destroyed. Wohlstetter started to see that with the emergence of the early days of smart technology, of much more precision targeting of nuclear weapons, particularly of cruise missile technology, that this was in fact something that you could actually think more creatively about. In fact, it might be possible to have what he saw as a nuclear exchange on a more controlled basis, that it wouldn't in fact go global. So you would actually be able to use nuclear weapons certainly in a theater way, if not on a battlefield way. So Wohlstetter saw this emerging technological innovation on part of American military technology, which introduced the concept that war fighting was something which could be carried out in a much more discriminatory way.
And then that in the next step in that evolution of ideas is that some of this technology could be applied to conventional weapons on the one hand, and also that you could be designed to limit collateral damage. The point being that giving the American arsenal weapons that could be used for interventions that might be related to ideas of American values transforming the world.
Precisely, yes, and I think that was the huge change here, which is that the linking of American power to the advancement of American ideals, and the fact that the that advances in military technology allowed you to imagine campaigns where the collateral damage which hitherto would have made war fighting would have just simply ruled it out, because you wouldn't have been able to control the impact on civilian casualties, suddenly became a possibility. You were able suddenly to imagine a campaign where the targeting was so precise and so controlled that this question of collateral damage became a negligible or a manageable component of your strategy. You were able to argue, at least with reasonable plausibility, that collateral damage was not intended and was kept an absolute minimum, and anyway was probably proportionate to the positive outcome. And this suddenly, instead of making war, you know, if you think about why the United Nations was set up after World War II, was actually to outlaw war, and that's in terms of self-defense. And after World War II, the United States and the rest of the Allies put the Nazis on trial for the crime of making war. So you had that concept, which was that war itself was a crime, and that it was something which should only be resorted to in absolutely last resort, and then really only with either a question of self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter, or as in part of a unanimous Security Council declaration resolution. Now suddenly all that changed, and you were able to see warfare as a much more viable and practical instrument of American foreign policy. And this is where the neoconservative embrace of ideals of American democracy and so forth suddenly were linked to the means to put those into effect, and that had a tremendously enabling aspect for their ideas.
And two important names here, both gentlemen being students of Wohlstetter, were Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz.
Paul Wolfowitz, no, precisely that, who emerged in under the Reagan administration in important positions. Paul Wolfowitz, who was an ambassador in Indonesia, but also, and perhaps more importantly, was Assistant Undersecretary of State for East Asia, where he saw the overthrow of Aquino and the transformation of the Philippines into a functioning democracy. So he had first hand experience of that transformation. Interestingly enough, a transformation which caused a few raised eyebrows among his bosses, who didn't quite see things precisely his way. But anyway, he had
this would have been in the Reagan administration.
Under the Reagan administration, yeah. Yes, who didn't necessarily see this as a stability enhancing development. And Richard Perle, who had a checkered relationship with then Secretary of State George Shultz, but ended up with an important contribution at the Reykjavik summit with then Soviet leader Gorbachev, when he defended cruise missile technology. In fact, Ronald Reagan was tempted to try and go to zero on that, and Perle said, "Oh no, we mustn't give that up." So he as a descendant of the Wallstetter philosophy, saw the possibilities and the need to retain that technology, not to give it up.
Now it's important here to note that the neoconservative, many of them left the Democratic Party, supported Reagan. But then in the latter part of his administration, when he moved toward recognizing the possibilities of Gorbachev and wanting to go toward arms control, some of the neoconservatives broke with him.
Absolutely, that was a disappointment. They had come up at the beginning of the Reagan administration. They had tremendous expectations for that Reagan would support them, and you remember his famous evil empire speech was mm-hmm. kind of played into that. But there's a very interesting aspect, because the neoconservatives today write as though the Reagan era was a sort of golden age. Mm-hmm. That there you had a man who was strongly ideologically committed and saw the power of American military force. In fact, if you look at particularly at the second Reagan administration, you see a man who was much more aware of the full range of instruments available to the United States and played his cards a great deal more carefully and a great more sort of subtle sequence than the neoconservative today would lead you to think this is their interpretation of Reaganism. Reagan was successful really because he stuck to this sort of the golden rules of American diplomacy, which is to use the full range, to persuade, to listen, to offer aid. He worked with the Polish steel workers, used the AFL-CIO, was working with the Pope who has just died. So he was very much not one of these sort of bludgeoning military option first unilateralists that in the sense that the neoconservatives would have you imagine with some of their writings.
He understood the politics part of international politics, I guess.
That's what I'm saying. He understood that by working with the grain, you can sometimes achieve, you can usually achieve things more easily than if you try and bludgeon your way forward.
Now, over these years, there was a generational change among the neoconservatives, and this new generation, represented by Irving Kristol's son, William Kristol, and other names that don't come to my mind right now, but I'm sure you can think of them. These individuals had came to have a much more ambitious view of how American power could transform the world when we compare them to, for example, Irving Kristol himself, who had a more limited notion that the U.S. could go in somewhere and, for example, change a Muslim society to a Western democracy.
Right. Now, the first generation was more broadly focused, on, particularly both domestic and internationally, and didn't really have the idea. They were strongly anti-communist, but the idea and strongly opposed to things like détente, but were not expeditionary, in a sense that this later generation. And one of the reasons for that, of course, was that the military technology was not yet available in the 70s and 80s. But what happened in the 1990s, which is really where modern neoconservatism started to take root, was that under the Clinton administration, and the Clinton administration was everything that that neoconservatives didn't like. It was unfocused, it was unconceptualized, it was random, it wasn't particularly interested in international affairs. It occasionally talked a big talk over the Balkans, but never actually did anything. It talked a big talk about responding to terrorist attacks, but never in fact followed through. And during the 1990s, Irving Kristol's son Bill Kristol, John Podhoretz, John Bolton, Jim Woolsey, then in the CIA, started to put together a very strong blueprint for American intervention in the Middle East. And I think their strategy behind that was a very far-reaching one, which was that the United States risked getting embroiled in some extremely uncomfortable and awkward challenges in the Middle East, brought about by the basic instability of the area. And they saw that if America was drawn into that, there were just simply no good outcomes for the United States. And so they developed a concept which would somehow see American power intervene there and try and unleash a sort of democratic cascade. And Iraq was a particularly suitable choice to start that enterprise, as much as it was headed by an international villain like Saddam Hussein. It was relatively relatively doable in a sense. So Iraq was a weak country, unlike Iran, a much tougher proposition in the area, although arguably much more the source of instability in the Middle East. So Iraq was a really good place for neoconservatives to develop this idea of linking the advancement of American ideals, sort of Wilsonianism, hooking it up with American power.
So in the end, I think in summary, one could say that these set of ideas came into play after 9/11 in a very powerful way, and ultimately focusing on Iraq, whether or not Iraq had anything to do with either 9/11 or Al-Qaeda. So the power of these ideas, in a way, put aside what we were talking about earlier, namely understanding the culture, the history, the tradition in place. I guess one would have to say these ideas were married to America's newfound military power, summarized in the term shock and awe, to hope that a major transformation could occur in Iraq. And when you put this all together, I think what you're really saying is that an interest group in the way that George Washington warned about in his first inaugural address, or in his farewell address, had come into play in the American system with the detrimental consequences that you've talked about.
I think that's right. I think what one is saying here is that the idea of attacking Iraq was around well before 9/11. I mean, Paul Wolfowitz, for example, is on record saying that he'd been interested in intervening in Iraq since 1979. So it goes a long way back, and the reasons for neoconservative interest in Iraq have much more to do with transformation of the region for democratization of the region than they have ever had anything to do with 9/11 or terrorism or anything like that. I think it was much more this trying to bring about a greater stability in the region for what they saw as good American reasons, and concentrating on that part of the world to the detriment of elsewhere. And I think that's where you would describe them as a special interest group. In other words, they did bring a really very limited range of of ideas and interests to the table, and which they represented as the whole of American foreign policy, and that the mistake, if that it was a mistake, is in enabling them to go ahead with those projects to perhaps the detriment of wider American interests.
Our political system and its vigorous pluralism is in play here, and should have been a check on some of the excesses of this policy, if that is what they were. Why did they not come into play? Why didn't our political system, and here I'm talking about the opposition party and the Congress, or the media, or alternative research institutes in Washington, why were they not able to come into play to at least call into question some of these policies?
Yes, well, I think the reason for that was that, in a sense, 9/11 almost created a perfect storm. There was this combination of fear and trepidation, and at the same time there was this there was a blueprint brought to the table to respond to this this moment of trepidation. And in a sense, once this ship was launched, once the idea that the response to terrorism was going to go after the states that harbored it, so not just the Al-Qaeda franchise itself, but after the state sponsors of terrorism, so-called, Iraq was practically doomed from that point. And at that point, a rather narrow decision-making process took over. Many of the opposition groups, I think, or the groups who might have been able to bring alternative thinking to bear, were intimidated by those circumstances. I mean, clearly the country wanted a strong response to 9/11. The administration was extremely successful in setting up a sort of discourse, a national discourse, which suggested, without actually necessarily saying so expressis verbis, but suggested that Iraq was somehow behind much of the terrorist planning of the world. And I think the establishment political institutions, particularly in Congress, failed to see what was going on. After all, you think the person who crystallized the opposition best of all was the governor of an obscure state that nobody had ever heard of before, Howard Dean. He was the person who brought the energy to the debate, rather than the mainline Democratic opposition. The media was also, I think, partially responsible here, and they've conducted a certain amount of soul searching. The New York Times, the famous article, confessed to not being sufficiently skeptical about the administration's claims on weapons of mass destruction. The Washington Times has done a sort of self-criticism, but I think the media was also perhaps not as critical as it should have been. And then I guess we can't absolve the rest of us from complicity in this. If you don't follow international affairs closely enough to be able to bring popular opinion to bear, then the fault lies with the rest of us as well. So I think this was a failure of the political system on a fairly broad scale.
Where do you see the balancing coming? Because clearly now we're in Iraq, and it seems that a new consensus is emerging, and I guess a component of that is picking up the pieces, basically. So I guess there are two questions here. Where do you think a new consensus emerges to help us deal with the situation we've got in? And then in the longer term, where will the balancing come from? Will it be within our own political system, or will it be from other major actors like Europe and China, who will not be captured by a comparable narrow interest group and may have a diplomacy that draws more broadly on the kind of diplomacy you were talking about earlier in your career?
Right. I think that what you're seeing today is, in a sense, almost a realization among the administration itself that perhaps it went a little bit overboard on Iraq. I mean, the president himself has taken some constructive steps, I think, since his re-election. He's reached out to Europe. He's taken a more conciliatory tone towards Iran. So I think there's a sense there that perhaps the allied component needs to be drawn in a little bit further. And I think that's maybe produced some beneficial results. There is less neuralgia around today. The tone is a little bit better. The European allies themselves think, I think, that we have to put Iraq behind us. We have to get on with the process of whatever you think about the war itself. We have to get on with helping it rebuild. French and Germans are taking an active role on a cancellation of debt and so on. So I think that inside the administration, there's already a little bit of balancing in the direction of the more traditional approach to American diplomacy. Now, on the international side, where the balance is going to come from is an interesting question. The Europeans would certainly see themselves as supplying that balance, as the famous phrase of a former Prime Minister of Britain, Harold Macmillan. He said that Britain wanted to play the part of the Greeks to the America's Rome. We are so smart; these guys have got all the muscle. So I think that's a sort of European, a rather snobbish sense that, you know, that they've got the diplomatic brains and can guide. I doubt that that's going to happen. Really, I don't think the United States feels in any way under-equipped in terms of diplomatic intelligence today vis-a-vis Europe. I think China is a much more interesting case to think about. China is obviously emerging on the world stage as a very dynamic power, even in America's backyard. It's now linking up with people like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Luis de Silva in Brazil, making major purchases of Latin American goods from countries like Venezuela, which are not in Washington's good books right now. And China has, in a sense, just the mass, the size, the buying power, the population, to play this kind. It'll say to the United States that here is a power you've got to take very seriously, not just because we want to give you good advice, but because we're actually a huge player on the international stage. So I think the role of China as a balancer is going to be one of the key factors over this coming century. And if the United States can manage its relationship with China, then I think we're in for an era of considerable prosperity and peace. On the other hand, if that goes wrong, then who knows what may happen. But come back to the early part of your question. There does seem to me that it's at least arguable that there is a new consensus emerging in Washington today, which is going to combine both elite liberal thinkers and liberal thinkers, people like Richard Holbrooke, Madeleine Albright from the left, and from the New Republicans, that does see this sort of union of American power with American values as, in a sense, providing the new sort of shape, new paradigm for American policy, not to be used in that rather sort of cavalier, dramatic sense that it was used at over Iraq. But nonetheless, that has sort of been the basic underlying concept under American foreign policy, which will bring about a very interesting a challenge for the rest of the world, that whether they will see the United States as a status quo power, interested in stability and maintaining global order, or whether they will come to see the United States as a revolutionary power, sort of 1920s, unleashing the bug of self-determination around the world, and who knows with what consequences. And those are two very different postures for the United States.
Now, embedded in all of this, of course, is the problem of terrorism, which is a real problem if it was misconceived by the Bush administration. That's another question. So the issue, and you point out in the book, very effectively that there was a misunderstanding of modern terrorism, transnational terrorism, that can be disassociated from any state sponsor, and for which it's very difficult to find the leadership and so on. I'm curious, do you, with this new consensus, envision a better understanding of terrorism by the American political system, and then a calling into play of the other instruments of power that you're so familiar with, diplomacy, the battle over ideas, and so on and so forth, and not just a reliance on the military power?
I think probably not. It seems to me that this new consensus is very state-focused. It's focused very much on democratizing other states and assuming that that's going to take care or at least address the terrorist problem of itself. Now, I think that's a very arguable, debatable proposition, whether, for example, if you unleash democratization in Saudi Arabia, what you'd actually come up with there. Would it be a liberal, pro-Western market democracy, or would it be something, in fact, very much worse, more adverse for the United States? So I do think that this thinking still does remain very much in the sort, in a sense, rather oddly, in the traditional state-on-state concept of thinking of international relations. And terrorism, I think we've really got to get away from that. We've got to see that this is a much more complex challenge for all of us, really, that something like Al-Qaeda is a franchise. It's diffused around the world. It can operate with very little money, can operate with very little leadership structures. And if we continue to think of it as in a sort of body count way, you know, we've killed three people here, five people there, we've hit their head of planning as though Al-Qaeda was a sort of an IBM, you know, which had these sort of organizational structure, which if you take down somehow...
Corporate headquarters,
exactly, where it really doesn't at all have that. And I think so. That's going to require a total rethinking, I think, of this idea that somehow, you know, that American ideals and power are the way to confront this. This is going to need a much more long-term and subtle interface with the countries concerned, and more gradualist. Yeah, as well.
And where will that insight come from? I mean, I'm bothered by the notion that one doesn't see how we as a country will come to that realization. Will the initiative come from the Europeans with regard to these insights?
I think the initiatives, I say, are going to come from probably from the domestic circumstances themselves of these countries. If one, for example, looks at now relatively encouraging developments between Palestine and Israel, what was the key catalyst of that was clearly the death of Yasser Arafat, and the administration's ability to take advantage of those sorts of developments, I think, are going to be absolutely key here. And if that they can do that, and there are some signs that is happening, that they are beginning to see that these are developments they can piggyback off of and advance American interests. If that happens, then I think the prospects for addressing this problem are considerably enhanced.
So the understanding of terrorism may come as we resolve some of these situations where the terrorists are emerging from.
Or I think so. Yes. I mean, it seems to me that the Arab Israel dispute is not the full explanation of terrorism. Clearly, it's not. Osama bin Laden himself was motivated much more by developments inside Saudi Arabia rather than Arab Israel. But clearly, that's also a very major part of that. And for the United States, which I think over the past 5 years, certainly the first Bush administration, did tilt, neglected this problem with tremendous disadvantage of the United States and tremendous encouragement of international fermentation of anti-American feeling, and I think that was a bad mistake. It was mainly predicated on the personality of Yasser Arafat, who became completely persona non grata in Washington. Now that that situation has evolved in a positive direction, that if the administration continues to be as actively engaged in it as it is, and there are going to be some difficult moments ahead, I think that's going to go a long way towards assuaging one of the breeding grounds of international terrorism. Now we look elsewhere. I think Saudi Arabia is the absolute key here. Now the Saudis are, on the one hand, aware that they need to move in the direction of taking the lid off the sort of pressure cooker that is the Saudi political, repressed political system today. But they're also tremendously concerned about importing trained insurgents from Iraq. They see that the Iraq experience is giving Saudis a sort of free education in how to run insurgent governments. So once again, you're talking about an approach to that problem which is subtle, long-term, multifaceted, rather than the sort of bludgeon. There are still some neoconservatives around who say that what we should do is try and support the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia to break away from Saudi Arabia and to let the kingdom disintegrate into pieces and see what happens. But that's
sort of the Shia sections.
Precisely, yes, and they're the oil fields. You know, and if you say to yourself, is that a sensible policy? I mean, I think the answer is a resounding no.
One final question: how would you advise students to prepare for the future in which they want to understand their country's foreign policy, whatever country they're from? I mean, do you have any points of advice for them?
Well, I think the one thing, of course, the key realization is to know that foreign policy is going to be a big part of their future lives, that the United States is integrated into the rest of the world in a way that is irreversible, that their welfare, their job chances, their whole lifestyles, really, are going to be crucially dependent on how the United States interacts with the rest of really practically whatever they. You know, you can be a farmer in Nebraska, and you say, well, that's pretty cut off from the rest of the world. Not at all. Who is the main customer? China. So the world is a tremendously integrated place. And I think the advice to students is to be very much alive to that fact, and that foreign policy is, in fact, a relative. Well, on one hand, it's fairly accessible because travel today is easy, and getting out and about is an easy thing to do. On the other hand, there are some lessons you've got to learn. There are there's a bit of a heavy lifting to be done here, which is understanding languages, foreign cultures, people. They're not all precisely like ordinary Americans, and I think that probably is the rather broad brush advice that I would give, is that foreign policy is vital to their future welfare. Also, it's kind of fun as well.
Jonathan, on that note, I want to thank you very much for coming to Berkeley and being with us today. Thank you.
Great pleasure to talk to you, Harry.
And thank you for joining us for this conversation with history.